The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made a start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here's the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Friday morning Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for giving us a listen to today. We have a great show with one of our favorite guests, John Bucknell. First, a couple of quick announcements. This is July 4th weekend. So, first of all, everybody have a great weekend. Really enjoy it. And be happy that we're making progress with our health and knocking down the virus, and it's going to be a very different July 4th than last year, and we should all cheer and be happy. But be safe, don't be stupid, and stay healthy. And for those of you in the western states that are listening to this, give us a break and don't play with fireworks this year. The drought, the fire risk, it's really, really severe. I can tell you from where I am, everything is just tender, dry, waiting to burst into flame. Like when I was a little kid, wouldn't play with a magnifying glass to see if I could catch a piece of paper on fire. My eyeglasses could catch the grass on fire out here. Everything is so dry. So no fireworks, please, no matter where you're living out here in the West. One other thing, whoever's calling the Space Show, I'm not going to answer your phone. We haven't even introduced our guest yet. You don't even know what he's going to talk about. So why don't you just sit tight and give our guest, John Bucknell, a chance to introduce himself and tell us what the topic is going to be, and then we welcome your call. Come on, give us a break, listener, and we want you to call back, but let John have a chance to tell you why he's on the show, and we're going to do that in just a minute. There's no show on Sunday. It is July 4th, and we're celebrating that. My flag is already flying outside. But there will be no show on the 4th. We do resume our Space Show programming on Tuesday. And the following week, everything is back to normal. And so everybody party hard, but stay well, stay healthy, and always, always, always look up, as we like to say when we're getting ready to end the show. Our website newsletter is posted, although it changes tomorrow. And even though there's no show on Sunday, I will update the newsletters tomorrow, and that'll be the upcoming show menu and the email newsletter, which will still go out on Monday the 5th, which is the legal holiday for the July 4th. And all of that will be current as of tomorrow afternoon California time. And we urge you to check it. We have a full week of programming coming up. A couple of other quick things to mention. Everything we do is archived, so you can, you know, listen right off of our website, download programs, or listen on the podcasting. Don't forget that we have a Space Show store. You access it by clicking on the photos of Pepper listening to the Space Show. The Listen Live button up in the upper left corner tells you how to listen to the live broadcast, which is what we're doing now, and also how to listen to MP3 archives on our website and podcasts. I'm happy to troubleshoot with you and help you out if you need it. Just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget that we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and our parent is One Giant Leap Foundation. We're listener-supported, so this means people like you, including the gentleman or the lady who was calling before we really got the show started. You guys support us and help us stay on the air and help us have programs like we have today with John Bucknell. So if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. And we need your support, and we hope you will support us. There's a huge PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support us. And if you don't want to use PayPal, you can mail a check to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation, Box 95, Tiburon, T-I-B-U-R-O-N, California, 94920. And we deeply, deeply, deeply appreciate your support. As this is a 90-minute show, I will talk about our sponsors later in the program, but we do have sponsors. They have banner ads on our website, which they can change whenever they want. We shout out to our sponsors, and today, because it's 90 minutes, I'll read the short sponsor messages later from Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. If you, too, would like to be a sponsor and have your promo message and your banner ad live in perpetuity, which is what happens on the Space Show website, as we still have our 2001 programs archived from 20 years ago, email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. John Bucknell is our guest today. He's been on the program about three times before. I believe this will be his fourth visit. He's a graduate from Cleveland State University. He had a BS in mechanical engineering, the University of Michigan later on with a master's in systems engineering. He's advanced engineering teams at Chrysler and GM, and he also was a senior propulsion engineer for the Raptor full flow stage combustion methane rocket at SpaceX. He is now doing something a little different. He's left California. Wise right there, wise beyond his years for leaving California. And he is the CEO and founder of Virtus Solus Technology. And you can access that website, virtusolis.space. And he's going to, instead of talking about nuclear energy today, which we usually talk with John about, we're going to talk about a special kind of solar. John, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
Fine, and great to have you back on the show. So you've gone from nuclear to solar. Tell us what's going on with you.
Yeah, so that's a long story. For those listeners out there, I'm now advanced age. I'm 50, and I've spent my entire career working on other people's visions, right? And working on those things that make small changes in the world. I've wanted to make a big change, ever since, I was young enough to think about it, old enough to think about it. And, it's been a long time, especially since the rise of, molten salt reactors for nuclear power in the early 2000s, been focusing on the energy challenge that we as a species, deal with on a day-to-day basis. And I spent a lot of time studying, researching. I've published a couple of papers on the topic. I'm involved with the Thorium Energy Alliance. I've been to the conference, spoken on these topics. And, this is the underlying desire on my part to make a little better place. And if you look around, and you'll see this on my website, the underlying challenge that we're dealing with is that the primary energy, which just means the root source of any energy that humanity is using, is still predominantly fossil fuels, between petroleum and coal. And while I'm, heavily in favor of nuclear, and I spent some time and actually decided to do a PhD in nuclear engineering at age 45 before I joined my last startup, just because I thought the world needed my knowledge and expertise and drive, there are only a couple of solutions that are scalable that could help us decarbonize. And the reason decarbonization is important is just because the death per megawatt hour generated, at least on the electricity side, let alone all the other uses of fossil fuels, is very high. And getting rid of a finite resource that's not equitably distributed around the planet and accessible to all, we should have energy, which is the enabler, the multiplier for everything humanity does, be equally available and low cost, that's that we all of us can realize our best life, right? And you'll see some of the statistics, and I've extracted these from a variety of sources, but the primary energy use, which means everything that you use, whether it's driving your car or you're running a microwave oven or the industrial uses to grow your food, we in the West, U.S., as of 2018, each and every one of us, man, woman, and child, consumes about 9 kilowatts of electricity. That's a sizable amount. it's more than most households consume electricity alone. So there's a lot of others, including fossil fuels that are powering aircraft. But the worldwide average is 1.8 kilowatts. And we know from a number of sources that of that roughly 10 billion people that live on the planet, about a billion of those have effectively zero energy consumption, at least from the sources that we're familiar with. So you'd argue that the vast majority of the world is living in energy poverty, at least compared to what we have in the prosperous West. And so if we want to make a big difference, we need to address the underlying energy issues. And if those of you who've been around long enough watch the prices of commodities in the last 20 years, and they've risen dramatically. The cost of gasoline for your car, and that ends up being the price of food because of the tractors that are needed to run the farms. All things have gone up because of the underlying cost of petroleum. Now, other portions of the economy, the electricity's been relatively stable, cheap. I know in California that hasn't been the case. I bought a Chevy Volt about 3 years ago. That was the last program I worked at GM in 2011. And it, to me, it was great to have an electric car, but plugging into the wall and charging from the grid in Los Angeles was as expensive as buying gasoline. And the gasoline prices in California are not inexpensive either. So even though, I should have had a very low-cost way to get around, the truth of the matter was that it didn't matter whether I used gasoline or electricity. I was still paying about 30 to 35 cents a kilowatt-hour. At best, and at worst, several dollars a kilowatt hour for electricity. It just drove me crazy.
Well, of course, the electricity comes from fossil fuels, so you're still using fossil fuels to create your electricity. And you're lucky. The gas taxes in California went up again on July 1st. We're now the absolute highest gas tax state in the country with about 51.8 cents per gallon state gas tax. So really charming.
Yeah.
And PG&E just announced a $35 billion rate hike to say that they need it to fight wildfires. Of course, they've been raising the rates by billions every year, saying they need to fight wildfires. I'm not sure that progress is being made here, but you're lucky you're in Michigan. I don't know what else to say.
For sure. And the infrastructure in Michigan is quite a bit nicer, but, I haven't had a blackout yet. I don't know about you, but my air conditioning's been great, and we've had a lot of rain here, frankly. So there's other parts of the country that are suffering, but weather per normal in Michigan. But I have a few other things to talk about on the energy grid, at least in California, as we go forward. So we can circle back around to that.
So what is different with your use of solar power than other space solar power projects? What are you doing different? Because we've talked space solar power for 20 years on the space show.
Yeah. So let me this is going to be a long answer, and hopefully we'll have time to cover all the topics we want to get to today. So those of you who have been long-time listeners and understand the subject, space solar power is not new. Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, the same guy that wrote the rocket equation, proposed it, I think, in 1921. Isaac Asimov wrote the first story about it in 1943. Dr. Peter Glaser did the first engineering design proposal in 1968 while he was working for Arthur D. Little for NASA. And NASA spent most of the 70s studying this, and they built a reference design in 1979 and had two more passes at space solar power through the 80s and 90s, culminating with Dr. John Mankins, who ran that effort from the late 90s through mid-2010, trying to make it better. And the underlying challenges for space solar power, and one of the biggest ones is that it's been thought to be a dead dinosaur that never worked. And unless you understand the reasons why it didn't work in the past, you can't make any new progress. So, David, I know you've talked about it our listeners probably don't know much about it, but I bet you can answer if I ask you, why didn't it work in the past? Do you have a good guess?
Well, I have two guesses, okay?
Okay.
So, number one, probably I have a multi-guess. Number one, it was designed and presented as a mega public project that had no economic sense to it and no will from any politicians to get involved with it, and science advisors to different presidents had their own special interests, which included nuclear and other different things, and they totally dismissed space solar power. And so for a variety of what I'm going to say, policy, economic, and political reasons, it never got any traction whatsoever, and the voices out there speaking for it didn't have any possible chance of closing a case to get it off the ground. But that's been changing with technology and as energy costs have been going up.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a big one. And I'll argue a couple other things before I get into the details of what we're proposing. But certainly the engineers and scientists and academics that have approached this problem generally do treat it as a public works problem, right?
Right.
We need an inexhaustible source of energy. Okay, well, how can we do it knowing where technology is at the time? And there's been a number of what we call summary papers or survey papers on the topic of this over the years. I mean, this idea from an engineering perspective is older than I am. There was one most recently by Paul Jaffe and a number of other people from the government and the military. And they all came to the same conclusion most recently, and like 3 years ago, is that, hey, look, launch costs are the biggest obstacle. And that's not true anymore. And it's really the difference between doing a public service project and having private businesses pursue the same goal is that the private businesses need to have it make economic sense in order for them to be
right,
make it viable. So the first domino is space launch being a commercial business. And, I was part of that at SpaceX, and, they're doing a great job, cornering the launch market. I don't know if you guys look up and can see the Starlink plan up there, but, from even 10 years ago, you would not have guessed that SpaceX was going to have more satellites in orbit than the whole rest of humanity combined, from then to now, and they intend to grow a lot. So the commercial aspects have to make sense. So these designs that are proposed as solutions to the world's problems need to be approached from a commercially viable perspective. And I hate to dunk on all those that have come before me, because certainly they solved a lot of the engineering problems that I would have to solve myself if they hadn't already done it. But they weren't coming at it from a design to cost.
No, big government projects, yeah.
Right. So these projects, if you're not sensitive to that, you're not going to try to control cost. And that's the bigger thing that we've done, right? And recognizing that space launch costs are low and are trending lower rapidly, and certainly the rocket engine I designed for the Starship, which should fly maybe this month on its first orbital mission, would go a long, long way toward bringing those launch costs down, which are key to putting infrastructure up in space. And if you argue, what methods are there to make money out of space?
Hey, John, just a minute. Listeners, yeah. I've opened our toll-free line. You have a good idea of what John's talking about. It is 866-687-7223. And if you call, we'll answer and put you on hold and bring you on air as soon as practical. So go ahead.
Yeah. So I guess the underlying question, if you're going to be a commercial enterprise and you want to operate out of space, what are the options for you to make money operating in outer space? And, certainly the first one is to, do government work. What are the government wants to do? And that's, how a lot of these, space launch companies have been funded. Certainly SpaceX is heavily in this category. So doing science missions and pure research are great, but those just aren't a large fraction of what's available commercially. So I'd argue that there's only like four ways to make money in outer space. And it's all because the customers are still here on this planet. The first one is telecoms, and that's been around for a long, long time. And that's the vast majority of what's on orbit already. The next one is the Internet of outer space, and that's already happening, and that's the reason why we have this proliferation of satellites between OneWeb and Starlink.
So what did you call it? I missed you.
I call the Internet of Space.
Internet of Space, okay.
Yeah. And then you know, there's the space tourism portion, right? Which it's kind of a catch-22. You need in-space infrastructure before your rich, you know, tourists come up and use it. And that's kind of, I mean, there are several plans. I mean, I've read about them, and I don't know how well they're funded, but there are plans to put up, you know, space hotels for rich tourists in the very near future. I don't know what the tickets will be like or what your stay is going to be like. At least my understanding of how the International Space Station stays sanitary doesn't sound super pleasant to me as a rich tourist, but hey, there you are. And then you look around, space mining, maybe. There's options there, but certainly you need the launch capacity to get up there, and you need a vehicle that doesn't exist at the moment to go where these large assets are and near Earth and bring them back so that you can harvest them. And those are generally the spectrum of what people talk about when they talk about making money in space. And those are pretty easily you can figure out, you know, where the revenue is coming from, because the Internet, the people on the ground are using, the science missions the government's using, the rich tourists are going to use the hotels, and obviously some entrepreneurs maybe is going to, you know, bring back some very valuable rocks. But they all are all heavily dependent on some other parts of the space infrastructure happening. And my goal is to get us up there, living and working in space, just like most of the rest of the listeners here. And you need to have that launch capability, which is coming, but then you need a reason to go into space. And living and working up there, you need some business that's viable. And that loops back around to space solar power, right? If you can make it commercially viable, then you're going to put more tonnage in orbit and, you know, in the cislunar space than anything else prior, because it's a huge project with a huge amount of potential customers, and it's going to take some amount of you know, real estate up there to do it. So with that in mind, what does it make? You know, what makes a space solar power system viable? It has a couple of advantages, and I'm going to excuse me if I'm repeating something that all of you already know. Believe it or not, the sun always shines when you're out of space. That's the biggest thing. The solar, utility-scale solar on the ground, if you have solar trackers on it, has what's called a capacity factor, have at best about 34%. And that's, you know, in areas where it's really sunny and there's no weather. Southern California is a good example, which means you put an asset on the ground to make energy, and then two-thirds of the time it doesn't do anything because either it's cloudy or it's at night or something like that. And if you design your orbit right, you can have something called sun synchronous. Your satellite can stay in sunlight all the time. So you already have a factor of three better than what's going on the ground. So there's a huge advantage there. The next bit is the intermittency, right? Because the sun's always shining, if you can transport that energy to the ground, you can have the ability to offset the need for storage and excess capacity on the ground, to, you know, for the lack of wind and sun. There are parts of this planet that have gone heavily into renewables and struggle with the, you know, inherent intermittency. The German state, about 20 years ago started incentivizing, renewables heavily, and, they're probably the best example of how not to do this. Because their energy cost to subsidize this build out, makes their energy costs even higher than California. They pay about 50 cents kilowatt hour, on average. And sometimes it spikes way up. And they had a period of about 2 weeks last October where the wind didn't blow and the sun didn't shine. It was all cloudy. And they just didn't have any, they haven't had any capacity to offset that. And so they've had to build, new, coal and gas fired power plants to support the intermittency of their, you know, infrastructure.
Don't they bring in energy from France? Bring in surplus nuclear energy from France?
They do, and that's one of France's. they're very proud that the Germans have to take their energy. But
yeah, I can imagine.
It's not enough. In fact, they built a natural gas pipeline from Russia to bring it in. But the thing that they did to themselves is they shot themselves in the foot. They've shut down the nuclear power as well. So, you know, they put themselves in a situation where, because their industry is able to make, you know, durable goods that are very expensive and can afford the, you know, the very high energy costs, they can do that. But that's not a solution for everywhere. But Germany is a way north. It's heavily impacted by weather. So where I was going with it is that the challenge is that you have all this renewable capacity. And I was living under L.A. Department of Water and Power's infrastructure while I was in L.A., and they put solar panels out in the desert outside the L.A. basin, right? It's very sunny there. I don't know if anyone's been out in the desert, the Mojave Desert, elsewhere, but it's miserable, at least for 6 or 8 months of the year. And they struggle with return on investment. They pulled out a new solar farms all around that basin, and they hundreds of miles away they'll ship the energy in over high tension lines. But the more power they put out, the more they have to turn it off. In fact, they had a goal by 2020 of having 30% of their energy grid be renewable, and they hit that goal in 2018. So they were way ahead of schedule, but their goal is to be 100% by 2050 and 50% by 2030, and they're finding the intermittency and storage problem is their biggest challenge, because they add more and more capacity. They have more than enough energy to supply the entire grid when it's all functioning.
John, but, just to let you know, I have a caller on hold waiting to talk to you.
Let me finish this thought, and then we'll go on that caller. And I guess where I call it that is that in the regions that have that capability of meeting all their generation needs with energy from solar panels out in the field, there's a curtailment period, term that's being used by the power industry, where they have to turn off capacity because it's more than they can use. And so the more they add, the more they have to turn off. So the return on investment for these new solar installations has gone down and down. They're really stuck, and they're probably the first to figure this out. And so the storage issue is the next big challenge, and the batteries is something we'll talk about in the near future. But space solar power solves that issue directly by not needing to have storage, because the energy is always available. So let's go to the caller, and we'll come back.
Okay. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. This is John in Fremont, California.
Okay.
Hi, John. It's good to talk to you again. We talked way back in 2017 when you were at the Starship Congress. And I don't see a lot of detail on your website about your solution. You're talking about a factory-built, high economy of scale solution, but I don't see anything. Is it all proprietary at this point, and you're not revealing the details, or what's your solution?
Great question, John, and we'll talk about a little bit of it today. I mean, certainly I have to get all our listeners up to speed. And as a startup, we talk about being in stealth. Stealth means that you're developing a technology, and you can't really say what you're doing until you protect it. And then there are aspects of the technology that you don't want anybody to know, so you don't want to file any patents, and those are called trade secrets. So you're right in saying, hey, John, how does your system work? There is just enough detail on my website to get people curious, but beyond what you've already described, I can't say a whole lot because of the proprietary nature of the technology, but we can talk about why it's proprietary and what those aspects are, then the things I'm solving that prior solutions haven't yet. So I intended to get to that fully today, and I will say that we've done a design-to-cost solution, which means that we've looked at every degree of freedom that would go into a solution like this and tried to pick the lowest absolute cost configuration, which means a lot of design decisions. You heard that I have a background in systems engineering, and often we talk about trade studies in systems engineering where you have a huge number of options on what you could do, and picking the one that gives you the answer that you want is hard generally, and so you end up having to do a lot of detailed analysis to figure out what the best answer is to solve your problem. And at the end of the day, the decisions we make as engineers and scientists to get to the best solution are, that's the secret sauce, right? So I apologize for being light on the discussion, but I'll talk about in-space construction versus on-ground construction as a really good example of what not to do as far as in-space construction goes. And the reference design that NASA did in 1979 assumed that they're going to do the Gerard O'Neill thing. We're going to build habitats in space. We're going to put hundreds of thousands of men in orbit, and we're going to mine the moon and build these solar power satellites that satisfy the world's energy needs. And sitting here in 2021, we look around going, who's going to pay for all that? Because to get to the end goal of energy, you need to have a production facility set up on the moon. You have to have launch capacity that's putting up hundreds of millions of tons at costs that we can afford. We got to build a space station. We got to put the people up there that can live and work. And then we get the low-cost energy, right? And the capital expense to do that, I would argue, is probably in the tens of trillions of dollars. And there is no source of money for any private enterprise to do that, let alone a government-backed enterprise. I mean, certainly it's conceivable, those of us who watch what the U.S. government spends and goes, why are we throwing a lot of money, you know, in the circular file every day? But in-space construction and localized construction is a really bad economic solution to a problem. The best way to build lots of something is to make it factory-built and making the same thing over and over again. So you get amortization of your construction equipment very quickly. And if you're doing it at least on the ground where all your, you know, technical people are, you can learn and redesign and make improvements. And economies of scale is not something maybe all of us appreciate, but all the durable goods we enjoy on a daily basis are there because economies of scale make huge sense, right? Like when I was working in the automotive industry, we would make a prototype of a car, the very first example of something that would sell for $20,000, $25,000. It would cost us $1 million in bits. And you can imagine that's where most of the aerospace industry is. I think the largest volume production element ever come out of the aerospace industry was the 747 at its height in the 80s and 90s, and it was being made for about $1,000 a kilogram. You know, the stuff at SpaceX, we weren't there yet. I think the forthcoming Starship is probably going to beat that. I hope it does, because that would make it good for all of us. But designing something that can be factory-built, tested, and put in orbit and require minimal touch work once it's there is a, you know, the only way to do an economic solution. So that's, you know, I mean, it looks like a simple decision to make. Yeah, just make it factory built. But then there's all these other constraints with, like, the launch vehicles available. How big are their payload volumes? And, you know, what can your system survive from the launch? And how do you get the energy to the ground is another design decision, right? And we've chosen microwaves, and there's a lot of explanation about that that we can get to. But I'd argue that design to cost and the decisions you make around that give us a solution that gets us to a system that is economic from an energy perspective. And in the energy industry, we talk about levelized cost of energy, which means you take away all the subsidies and all the other backgrounds and compare on an equal basis different solutions. There's an investment bank called Lazarus who publishes a summary of those technologies for energy production and storage annually. And they say, okay, well, even though there are solar power plants in Dubai and otherwise that say, hey, we got 0.5 cents a kilowatt hour is what our price is. And they don't talk about the fact that there's another 2 cents or 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour of subsidies coming from the government to make that work. And then there's a solar investment tax credit that the U.S. government offers that gives companies a huge tax break on their tax bill to invest in infrastructure. So comparing on a levelized cost basis is the only way to know whether or not your technology is going to be viable and competitive in a commodities market, which is what energy is.
John, can I interrupt you for a moment?
Please.
What is the – and Fremont Johns, please – stay on the phone here. What is your company's TRL? I know you want to be proprietary, but for what you're working on, what is your company TRL, and how does that compare to the space solar power industry overall TRL?
Well, I don't know if we can talk about the space solar power industry, because as far as I know, there's only one or two other commercial ventures that are pursuing this. But obviously, the terrestrial solar is TRL-9, right? It's in production. Everyone understands it. They're in the, you know, driving the cost to the bottom. All the underlying elements, the solar cells are in production. The power conversion devices are in production. The microelectronics are in production. So those are all TRL-9. The long-distance wireless power transfer is not a TRL-9, although the underlying technology is. No one has ever tried to do large-scale wireless power transfer from orbital distances, and it's a catch-22 problem. You need a large array to hit targets from orbital distances, especially if you're not in low Earth orbit. We're talking about distances of 35,000 kilometers, roughly, at the apogee of our orbit. So that particular technology, demonstrating the wireless power transfer from orbital distances, is probably at TRL 5 or 6, depending on how you measure it. And that will be one of the very first things that our core technology will demonstrate, is the ability to do that, which no one has been able to do to date. So hopefully, I'm not trying to dance around the problem, but I mean, I'm in a commercial enterprise. I'm not in a technology development, portion. We're not trying to do something new that's a pure R&D effort. We're trying to do the dev part of R&D.
Okay.
And deploy existing technologies in a new way.
John, do you have more for him?
Yeah, just a couple of things. So you're going to launch everything from Earth. So to get a solar power satellite large enough to generate enough energy to be competitive with ground-based systems, you're going to have a lot of launches. I'm okay with that because the costs are coming down. You're saying that there isn't any solution where you can reduce the cost by getting materials from the moon or doing in orbit manufacturing?
I do not believe so, no. Because the challenge is you have to build a factory wherever you're planning on it, and getting a factory set up in orbit means that every single item that is going into the factory has to come from somewhere. So what you're talking about is creating infrastructure to build the factory, to build the product. So you're a couple of stages away from doing that, considering there's barely any humans in space at the moment and no manufacturing infrastructure up there, unless you count the 3D printer that's on the International Space Station.
Right. You're going to look for venture capital, right, to start your company?
Right.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
And did you happen to see the Fraser-Nash consultancy presentation at ISDC, Space Solar Power for the UK?
I frankly want to talk a little bit about the ISDC. There were, they had the Mankins presentation and then the Fraser-Nash consultancy evaluation, which came up, heavily in favor of space solar, which is great. Absolutely, I want to talk about that.
Okay, I'll get off the air. It looks like the UK might be a good market for you to start, because they're serious about it, and their net zero goals by 2050 are right in line with what you're doing.
Sure. Appreciate that. Thanks, John.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thank you, John.
Thank you much.
Okay.
Thank you much.
Listeners, the line has been cleared. It is 1-866-687-7223. And email remains drspace@thespaceshow.com. Do you have timelines that you're dealing with for commercial operations?
Absolutely. And certainly as a startup, you're you start small, right, and you do what you can with the funding you acquire. And I think that's one of the big things that allows us to talk about this freely on your radio show is that we have what we call pre-seed investors that have committed to capitalize our company and allow us to build our first prototypes. Obviously, timelines are what they are based on how much funding you raise and how quickly you achieve them. But I'd argue that the milestones for something like this is you want to do all your technology readiness level preparation and then do a demonstration, right? You want to get up and show that your product can actually do what you say it does. And that opens the door to customers who, depending on who you're talking to, are either super conservative or the other end of the spectrum. So you can talk about, hey, I have a viable product. Because a lot of the questions you get early on when you have a business, especially a technology business, and especially in a hardware technology business, which is probably the hardest type of business to get started, is will it work? Right? So your pictures are worth 1,000 words, but a functioning prototype is worth millions of pictures. So I am in the process of doing that. So we're going to try to get to an orbital demo about 18 months from our meeting our funding goals, and then from there, acquiring customers, building factories, and putting the rest up. And we hope that that will align with the forthcoming launch vehicle products from Relativity and Rocket Lab and SpaceX. We hope that we'll be able to competitively bid with all those organizations. But at least from my ex-employer, SpaceX, in order to get a ride scheduled, you have to put 10% down. So what's 10% of a Starship?
We
really don't know yet. But I wanted to talk about a couple other things.
Okay, hold on. You have another caller. Yeah. Do you want to take the other caller real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. Hi, John. This is Peter Schubert. I'm calling from Indiana, and I got a question for John.
Okay, go ahead.
So, John, you've worked closely with Mr. Elon Musk. And apparently he's not yet been an investor in this. I think I know his position on it, but it seems like this has such a strong, positive economic benefit that you would get attention from, for example, Jeff Bezos or Richard Branson or others in the billionaire class. But it seems like they haven't really stepped up to this yet. Can you give us any insight into the dynamics of that situation and whether you think it will be the billionaire class that will finally get space solar power to start to happen?
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, certainly you're dealing with very exceptional individuals when you're talking about the field that you just described. I mean, I'm 6 months older than Elon. I sat 6 desks from him while I was at SpaceX. He's a very focused individual, and he has his vision, right? It's hard to change his mind. I don't know if anyone has dealt with him, but he has things he wants to do and the way he wants to do them. I had the unfortunate desire to build nuclear rockets while I was there, and I got told, that's not the SpaceX way. We're not doing R&D on that type of technology that, you don't know whether it's going anywhere. So in some ways, businessmen are risk averse, right? And they generally tend to pile on once, something is shown to work, right? Elon wasn't one of those, but if you argue that Richard Branson didn't invest in Virgin Galactic and Virgin Orbital until they, won the X Prize for getting into outer space, and then I think I read last week that, Virgin Orbital, which you guys might know is the satellite launch wing of Virgin Galactic, they spent $1 billion to get a relatively small launch vehicle to fly. Building my own rockets, I was estimating somewhere in that neighborhood, and going out and finding investment capital is challenging because the investors want to make money, right? I hate to say this, but the billionaire class generally get there because they've made investments that made them a lot of money, or they found somebody else to finance it that made them a lot of money, so they have that kind of cash. But generally, these billionaires don't actually have cash, right? They have assets that are generally illiquid that make them very valuable, but they don't have a lot of cash lying around. I think I read this morning that Elon has sold all of his assets and was living in a $50,000 prefab house in Boca Chica next to the Starship launch thing. So I've heard stories about people like that, and basically what they do is they take loans against their assets to get cash for operations if they don't have a whole lot. But my expectation is that people who have a lot of money that are assets from their businesses aren't going to be the source of dry capital for this type of thing. It's going to have to be after you demonstrate that you have a functional system. Like, Bezos obviously, came to had rockets that work and hired a lot of people that knew how to build them. And then they have gone off and built their own. Richard Branson, again, after something has already been demonstrated. But there's lots of people investing in fusion energy, for example. And frankly, that's the U.S. government led from the funding perspective. But, there's a lot of companies that say they're really close, and I'll bet, and you guys all can watch, once someone actually does it and makes net energy, they will get a huge amount of more funding because that is the trigger for investors to join an organization because they're going to, get return on their capital. So I think it's all the people that have made money with prior investments and are willing to pursue investments, especially in the what you call impact investing, right? Things that are going to make the world a better place. I think those are going to be the source of the types of money that will be needed to do something like space solar power. So that's just my opinion. We'll see how it goes. I know Elon has a poor opinion of space solar power. And I understand his thinking, but I know he's wrong. So you can take that for what it is.
Thank you.
Anything else, Peter?
Well, I'm wondering if the United States government is going to pick this up, if it takes us a kick in the pants like it did with Sputnik, and it would take maybe a launch of a Chinese solar power satellite for us to finally go, oh, yeah, we can do this and now kick into action. Maybe that could be the dynamic that gets things started.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, certainly, the government has funded a huge amount of research. I mean, you argue that Moore's Law wouldn't have happened without government-funded research, and I 100% agree with that. I mean, what I'm doing today would not be viable without Moore's Law. I mean, what I can do from a simulation and design perspective with computational tools, I bought a supercomputer, something that again, all of the old guys remember when Cray was a crazy supercomputer back in the early 90s. And most of us have a supercomputer-level computational capacity in your pocket with a cell phone. I bought a $1,500 computer 2 years ago that is more computational capacity than I had when I did SpaceX 10 years ago. And I had a $20,000 computer back then. And that computational cost keeps coming down. And the commercial tools, at least from a technology race perspective, all the electromagnetics, all the simulation you need, all those tools are available to just about everyone at very low cost. And especially since a lot of software has moved to a subscription model, you can afford to pay $100 a month, $200 a month instead of putting out $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 for a software license. And that's generally an annual license for a lot of these expensive tools. So, small teams can make really big, progress in engineering of aspects. I mean, I like to say that the business I was in, I was a rocket scientist, but truly scientists, are not generally in the development business. They're in the research business. So I'm definitely an engineer, and I don't do anything that I don't know how to do already. So that allows us to do, specific development to specific goals very, very quickly and very, very low cost. So your government research money has helped, but there's also a huge reporting overhead. I've worked on Department of Energy grants over the years, and I haven't done any defense work, but the overhead for doing any money for the DOE is almost not worth doing. So my opinion is that it would have to be something like ARPA-E or DARPA, where they just fund research without a lot of strings attached. So unfortunately, the existing aerospace primes and similar generally swallow a lot of that investment. In fact, you guys know anything about space investment, you know that SpaceX has taken about 85% of the investment dollars worldwide in the last 5 years. So, you know, the rest of us are working from very little capital because the successful ones are able to raise all the money. Although I got to say, my colleague Tim Ellis has been doing a fantastic job at Relativity Space raising money. So it's possible. So that's just a stellar amount of money that they've raised without ever flying their first rocket. So good for them.
Peter?
Sir?
Hello.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the comments. Thank you.
Thank you. And listeners, the line is open again, and the phone number is 866-687-7223. So what's – I know you've got proprietary information, but can you give us an idea of what's unique or different with what you're doing versus Joe Blow down the street?
Yeah, well, let me back up, and I want to talk about a couple of other things, and ISBC is one of them. You guys might know, because you follow space solar power, there's actually a space solar power plant in orbit right now. I don't know if you guys knew that, but Dr. Paul Jaffe at the Naval Research Lab put his doctoral dissertation prototype up on the X-37, which is the miniature space shuttle.
He's going to be on the show for the second time. I think he's coming in toward the end of August.
Yeah, so his experiment called PRAM has been flying for over a year, and they're collecting power and simulating microwave power transmission, and that's been flying. It's been outperforming the estimates they made from the ground. But two other organizations are going to put up space solar power demonstrators this coming year. The first, and just so you know, the space solar power commercial groups are there's very few of us. There's a group in China. There's Ian Cash in the UK. There's the Caltech group, which is not really looking at commercialization, but they're doing basic research. And then you have the Naval Research Lab, and you have the Air Force Research Lab. So Caltech has been working for a number of years on space solar power. They've got three PIs, and I've talked to Dr. Richard Madonna a few times, and they're they presented a paper or published a paper about a month and a half ago that they made a lot of progress on their designs. The last time they published, I think, in 2017, that they intend to do a demo mission in December. They're going to fly on Momentus Space's space taxi. And also the Air Force Research Lab on a Kirtland Air Force Base is going to fly a demo mission called Spider in the same time frame. So it's conceivable if 37 doesn't come down again, we'll have three space solar power demonstration missions in orbit in the end of this year. So those aspects and the technology readiness level of a lot of elements that are in those components are going to raise a lot, and we'll have some actual data to look at instead of just modeling. Now, talking about ISBC, the National Space Society, I'm sure you guys know, outgrew from Gerard O'Neill, right?
Right.
He was the guy that was behind the idea of making space solar power something that supports us as a species. And they've got a fantastic library. If you ever want to read up on space solar power, I've probably read every document ever created on this topic. So a lot there. It was, I think 127 or 128 technical papers published over the years. But the presentation this year at ISBC, had John Mankins talk about comparisons between all the proposals out there and trying to compare them on a cost of energy basis. And if anyone knows Dr. Mankins, I sent him an email right after ISBC saying, hey, I can't duplicate your numbers. Can you share your methodology, because it would be very interesting to compare and contrast what he's proposing versus what we're calculating internally. And then the Fraser Nash Consultancy, which the British government had hired to look into how to energize the UK going forward with their intent of being net zero by 2050. And Ian Cash, if you don't know, has probably done the most detailed work that and published on the subject of space solar power in the last few years. It had a couple of satellite designs, one called Hesperus and one called Cassiopeia, which he's done all the electrical engineering background on it. They are very elegant designs. He got his design, one of the Chinese designs, which, by the way, they're also funded and working on it, like Peter Schubert said. But their timelines are 20, 50 or so, you know, having a viable product.
What's his name? What's his name again?
I think it's Hao Huang. Let me pull up.
Or what? You said the name of the company or the paper, and we didn't get.
I'm sorry. It's Ian Cash, is the guy in the UK. His company's name is International Electric.
Okay.
He is the one that has had some very good space solar power designs. And the presentation of the Fraser Nash Consultancy, which was hired to do techno-economic analysis on all the possible ways that the UK could power themselves in the future, including nuclear. And it's funny I say nuclear. It's actually nuclear. So just, even though in the business like to add that extra syllable in there. They came out, saying, hey, the economics of space solar power make a lot of sense. We should do it. And they evaluated Mankins' design, Mankins and his team's design. I would say it's strictly Mankins. He's got a book out, if you guys aren't aware, The Case for Space Solar Power, which highlights the SPS Alpha design that they came up with, which is a highly modular design, has a lot of things going for it. And we built off of some aspects of that technology for our. And then, obviously, in Cash's design, and then the Chinese design, which I'm blanking on the name. I've met him, but only through Dr. Jaffe's teleconferences we had through the spring. And they went through that and then highlighted, obviously, the British design because it's homegrown money. And they presented their results to the UK government while waiting to see whether or not they bite and fund the research. So lots going on in this, in the literature and in the news with space solar power, being seen and showing up again. Because for a long time, you wouldn't read anything about space solar power in literature at all. People have, obviously known about it for a while, but no one's talking about it. Now, because the viability is becoming possible, we're actually getting there. So I know, David, I'm coming back to your question.
And I have an email set of questions for you, too.
Okay. Well, let me finish answering. So the thing that we're doing different and something that Ian Cash is doing is that we're not going after geostationary equatorial orbits. The Delta V required to get from LEO to GEO, as most people know, is about half as much as it takes to get to orbit itself, and it's very costly from a mass perspective to get out there. And geostationary orbit is crowded. Lots of telecom there already, and regulatory bodies, especially the FCC, already have allocated all these orbital slots to existing telecom. So digging a slot out of what's already existing up there is hard from a regulatory perspective, right?
Right.
You're not going to be able to go and say, hey, I know you've been broadcasting here for 20 years, but get out. I've got a space solar power satellite to put up there. But the challenge with geostationary is that at the solstices, you're going to have your satellite in the Earth's shadow. And that's bad because your whole system shuts down. And it's for like a three-hour period twice a year. So eliminating the need for onboard energy storage is one of the big things we've done by doing an orbit that's called Molnia, which is Russian for lightning. But it's very similar to what's called a geostationary transfer orbit, which is an orbit that allows you to get from low Earth orbit altitudes to geostationary altitudes. So our apogee is about where geostationary is, but it's a highly inclined orbit. The Molnia orbits that you'll read about are 12-hour, and they're highly elliptical, which means the perigee is down around 800 kilometers, the apogee is about 35,000 kilometers, and they're sun-synchronous, and they're 12-hour. So we're doing an orbit that most other solar power systems have not identified as useful, and because it only takes half the delta V to get there, that's one big thing, and the other big thing is it is sun-synchronous. And the last big thing that we're doing is that our satellite's orientation to the sun does not change. So if you're in geostationary and you're spinning around your orientation to the sun once per 24 hours and your ground station is rotating below you, it means you need to have either your your sun absorbing PV panels or your transmit antenna have to rotate once per day. So you have to spend 360 degrees every day. That, from my perspective as a design engineer, moving kilowatts to megawatts to gigawatts across a rotary joint is a insurmountable engineering problem, and one that we've avoided by orbital mission design. So, anyway, that's what I can tell you, and we can debate the merits of that with the callers. But I'd like to hear what your caller has to say just now.
So you're talking about MOLNIYA, correct?
Yeah, pronounced Molnaya or Molnia. So I asked the German translator on Google, or the Russian translator on Google, how to say it. Molnia, but I talked to Jeff Bonneville, and he says Molnaya. So I don't really know how to pronounce it. I'm not Russian. So.
All right.
But, yeah.
John, who called a few minutes ago, sent in a couple of additional questions. And, listeners, you can send in emails, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or use the toll-free line, 866-687-7223. John says, does your system position the SPS, and you just answered this, but I'll ask his question anyway. Do you position the solar-powered satellite in geo or sun-synchronous orbit? If the latter, you'll need relay satellites to direct the beam where needed, correct? Also, what about the rectenna? Do you envision having to work with local utilities to place these for input to the grid?
Really good questions, and something that most investors will ask. So good news, bad news. You do not need to have relay satellites. That would be defeating the purpose. In fact, I've talked to some early investors, and they thought I was putting up space mirrors to redirect the sun down to existing solar power plants. And at the face of it, it sounds easy. You just put a mirror up, and the sun gets reflected and goes right exactly where you need it, right? Well, cases, the fact of the matter is that 35,000 kilometers away is a long, long, long way. And you need active optics on your reflector in order to get that sunlight to appear where your solar power plant is. So it's more expensive and heavy than my solution, frankly, to do a space mirror. And it doesn't do anything for you, just putting a mirror up there. But to answer John's question is that we're going to do a constellation of satellites that all can provide power to the ground 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And if you put, for example, a sun-synchronous satellite that has apogee at solar noon and at solar midnight on the same ground track, you basically have two ground stations on either side of the planet, 180 degrees apart, and you can power them alternately either during the night or during the day, depending on what your orbit is. And you can provide power when you need it, but it's just two arrays in your constellation. So in order to solve the other problem of siting, it's a health and safety question primarily. Our ground stations are very similar in size to utility-scale solar plants. Our ground station, our rectenna, is about 2 kilometers in diameter. And that allows us to put all of the energy that our satellites produce inside a existing footprint. That's about 500 acres, about the size of a 200-megawatt solar power plant. So it's very similar. So siting of the ground stations is the biggest challenge because you have to deal with all the local communities. My mother-in-law is visiting this last couple of days, and she had a local community that had a company want to come in and put a solar power farm in, out in farmland out in the middle of Michigan. And the locals didn't want it because it was ugly. And if the local powers that be don't vote to allow you to use the land, then, yeah, it's a challenge. So siting has to be something that you either have a utility give you the land, or you already have some access controlled land or something like that. So to help us, we have a strategic partner named Intersect Power, which is one of the largest independent power providers in the country. They're based in Portland, and they have about 3 gigawatts of renewable power on stream at the moment. So they're helping us a lot with that siting portion of it, of the business. So if you volunteer, if you have a big plot of land that you want to put a ground station on. We'll come talk to you.
So another email listener is Karen in Las Vegas, and she says, why do you have to go through all of this with site location and beaming? Why can't you beam directly to the end user with his own or her own small rectenna, such as DirecTV?
Great question, and another topic that one of my investors would love to be able to do. The short answer is physics, and I'll talk about this a little bit, and you guys can check me in literature. Spatial power has a couple of gating problems. Some of the early designs said that about a gigawatt is as small as you can make a spatial power system. We're saying that number is like 100 megawatts. And the reason is it's called optics and diffraction. So when you have photons transferring your power, and we certainly do, there's limits to how far you can get those photons to go in the same direction. And diffraction is the biggest challenge for wireless power transfer. So at that 35,000 kilometer apogee, the smallest spot size we can put on the ground is just under that 2 kilometer size that we're going to create. So if I were to deliver power to somebody's rooftop collector, I would have to provide power to them and everyone within a 1 kilometer radius. And there are, I hate to say it, but there's wackos in this world who worry about the microwaves that their cell phones are generating. And I would have to irradiate all of that. And the biggest challenge is economics, right? I would want all that energy to be harvested to pay for itself so that I can pay for my satellites, which is the biggest expense. So having individual, end users, collect energy, they'd have to be standing, shoulder to shoulder for quite a ways around. So at the moment, our siting is going to look a lot more like a utility scale solar.
Okay, you have another caller who wants a piece of you. You ready for this one?
Sure, go ahead.
Hi, caller. Welcome to our program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Good to hear from you. I hope your phone service is better today, or mine.
Yes, me too.
go ahead with John, please.
John, I'd like you to circle back to the batteries. You were going to talk about that one point.
Yeah, batteries is a big challenge. So let me just say that at the moment, lithium ion batteries are not scalable, period. They cannot solve the world's energy storage problems just because of there's some rare earth elements in their design construction that just there doesn't exist enough for the capacity we would need for global scale energy storage. There are other technologies, energy storage wise, that might be scalable, but they haven't been proven yet. But the biggest challenge, and this economics again, is that you need to buy enough storage that you can handle the periods of intermittency. So at the moment, intermittency is handled by the rest of the energy grid, and that means coal and gas-fired power plants coming online when the renewables can't. The energy storage systems you'll read about are generally small power capacity and short-term energy discharge. So what we would call those are time-shifting energy. What they're doing is they're charging them during periods when there's plenty of sunshine and then selling that energy when the sun goes down and, charging more for it because of that. So at the end of the day, battery energy storage means that you need to build excess capacity on your generation side, and then you need to build enough storage that you can store it for however long you need. And that however long you need is a big deal because some parts of the planet, we talked about Germany earlier, you might need 3 days, you might need a week of energy storage to offset the fact that your generation isn't doing anything. So I would argue that the least you can get away with is increasing your generating capacity by a factor of 5. And that's just to cover cloudy days. So you'd have to build 5 times as much generation capacity and then build at least 24 hours worth of storage, if not more than that. And at that point, even with today's best prices for energy storage, you end up with something that's 3 to 5 times as expensive as just the generation. So Lazard keeps that, you know, they have a levelized cost of storage analysis, but if you look at one of the charts on my website, there's a solar plus storage, line item, which says it's about $100 per megawatt hour is about the lowest energy storage can go. And that assumes 4 hours of energy storage at best. Usually it's about 2 hours. So, generally I don't see the battery energy storage as scalable at all.
I'd love to see you write up some of that somewhere on your. I mean, you see some of it's there. I'm looking at some of it. It's a fairly small thing, but
yep.
I've heard counter arguments recently, and I won't distract from the theme to get into that. But I'd love to see a post or something from you about it, so I could compare the two articles.
I tell you what. As soon as we raise our enough money to build a prototype, you will see me on a marketing blitz like you've never seen before. So, yes, well, we'll come out and talk about it, but the time's got to be right.
John, can I
– I hear you.
Can I step in with a question? Are you familiar
sure.
with JPL engineer Casey Handmer?
Casey,
that's the guy.
Casey and I disagree on the topic vehemently, and you can go read his blog, and you can read about my name in the comments. Keep me wrong.
I've got his Unstoppable Battery Onslaught article pulled up where it's sweeping the country, getting rid of natural gas plants. It's transformed everything, and
yep.
it's quite a different picture than what you're painting. So
I could be wrong, but my own analysis, which, I trust myself, I disagree with his assessment I don't even want to go into it, but I respect Casey a lot, and he's right on a lot of things. He's maybe right on the battery energy storage, but I don't think he's right on the scale required and the ability to scale. And I also disagree with him on whether he's right on the space solar power thing, because he's heavily against it. He says it'll never work. So anyway, Casey and I agree to disagree.
Okay. Okay. And by the way, while I do subscribe to Casey's blog, I do want to give Kim credit for calling this particular blog article to my attention a couple of weeks ago. So but I had it ready to ask you about today. So
appreciate that.
Kim, do you have anything more for John?
So would your service concentrate specifically on one specific ground station then? It wouldn't move around, wouldn't be a possible thing?
Oh, no, it's very mobile. In fact, one of the great things about doing our microwave power transmission, and you guys, it's not a big step to understand that we will be using what's called a phased array antenna to transmit mm-hmm. as microwaves. We can bop around on a second-by-second basis, anything in our field of view, and at Apogee, that's basically 50% of the Earth's surface. So, we intend to go whenever and wherever the energy is needed.
So then your clients, what kind of clients are you envisioning to start with?
So I think the earliest clients for earliest deployment are those communities that want renewable energy and can't get it. I think a great example would be the islands of Hawaii. Up until recently, they were 100% diesel generator powered. They've recently put in some small amount of solar capacity, but remote communities like that don't have alternatives are a great solution. And then, energy grids that are poorly run, maybe is the best way to say it, that could use low-cost energy when and where they need it. Because the biggest challenge, at least in the U.S., is not capacity or infrastructure. It's not when and where you need it. Like I was talking about earlier with LABWP, they have a lot of capacity, but it's not when they need it. They have too much, actually, during the day and not enough at night to provide low-cost energy. So it depends. Certainly we can tailor our systems depending on which contracts we end up signing, but I suspect it will be maybe doing large data centers. You guys might know that Microsoft has experimented with underwater data centers because about half of the energy they consume is for cooling of the computational capacity. And you probably also know that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies that require mining are just huge energy hogs to extract value. And all that could be solved if you, like, say, for example, put your data center underwater in the Arctic where the water is cold. There's a lot of it, but then how do you get energy to it? You could have a solar power plant providing that energy around the clock, even in, what do you call it, when the sun's gone for 6 months. So those are the types of customers that we'd foresee supplying initially. And large scale, conceivably, we'd go anywhere, for any conceivable use, because we believe we'll be cost competitive with every other form of energy. So we'll supplant existing power plants today.
Well, you indicate a very interesting selling point, actually, because if you can redirect the product second by second, then you could be servicing more than one customer at a time and get 100% utility out of your product all the time.
That's correct. In fact, that's probably the best way to use it, at least initially, because most of the developed markets have gone to demand-based pricing, right, which just means that they don't have enough capacity, so they charge you more for operating, especially if you have to bring online a natural gas-fired peaking power plant, who's very expensive to operate, because the other capacity can't load follow. And if you bring that in, you're going to basically do what Casey said. You're going to displace that that peaking capacity almost immediately because they're not cost competitive. And you can just walk your way across basically the terminator of the sunset. You can walk market to market to market as the demand from people coming home cooking dinner and the sun going down and the solar going offline. Those are very viable markets.
The next thing I wanted to ask about, maybe it opens up a bit of a can of worms, but you talked about government contracts in the context of being contracts for research.
Mm-hmm.
And you referred to the work of the Chinese teams working on this product. Well, they've announced, I'm sure you're aware of this, that they've announced official plans to put a space shuttle power plant up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the Sputnik thing that the caller from Indiana maybe is referring to. If mm-hmm. suddenly you're talking about a major rival possibly supplying potential allies in the third world with cheap energy that they absolutely depend on China for, that could be turned off at any time. And the capacity to beam power to military operation in a remote area like the Himalayas, let's say, then the strategic value to the American military and the American in general, never mind anybody else in the world, but let's just start there, really changes. So maybe suddenly their interest in paying for you to launch your product would change.
I totally understand the sentiment, Kim, and let me give you a little perspective, and we can talk about it further. I don't believe the Chinese space shuttle power system will be economic. Straight up. I don't think it will be. Everything, and there's not much, everything I've seen on it, it looks like copycat of stuff that's been done in the West, specifically Caltech and Northrop Grumman, who work with Caltech, who's now working for the AFRL. All their designs are derivatives of systems like that. And there was an announcement this last week or week ago prior about the new Long March 9 rocket being able to deploy space solar power systems by 2050. So, we're talking a few years away from now. And all these deployments saying, hey, we'll have our first commercial operating system 30 years from now. And as a businessman, if I have to wait 30 years to be commercially viable, I'll be in my 80s, and I don't think I'll be ready. I'll be able to work that hard on it. So the argument I have is that if it's commercially viable and somebody figures out how to do it, they'll own the market. There won't be any other markets because everyone else will be 5 to 10 or 30 years behind. So, and frankly, the other big thing, and I'll talk about this a little bit, is I said earlier that, you know, my goal is universal prosperity, right? And from a military strategic perspective, my goal is to make everyone happy so there won't be any military challenges. Imagine the best case, right? I deploy all these factories. I make a ton of money. I'm supplying the world as a global utility of energy. You know, how do I spend that money that I'm making? Obviously, I'm going to invest in new power plants to provide more and more markets. But, you know, there's going to be, you're going to be able to lobby governments, do policy type things. So conceivably, you're actively working toward making the world a better place with the monies you acquire through this endeavor. So I don't know how much influence I'll be able to have over the world, but if it goes very well, then it's conceivable that the military needs for remote energy will be able to obviate. You won't need them anymore. So anyway, that's my utopia, is that everyone's needs are met and you don't have to have conflict anymore. So we'll see if I, you know, make any dent in that, but that's the desire.
Yeah. Well, if nobody tries, it doesn't happen, right?
That's for sure.
Anything else, Kim?
No, I think those were all great answers. Great show.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thank you.
Listeners, Kim cleared the line. It is available, and there is still time if you want to call 866-687-7223. One thing you haven't said, and I've got another email to read, and I don't think there's an answer to this. Once you bring your power down and it gets into the grid and you want to make me happy, unfortunately, there's a power company called PG&E that is not going to make me happy no matter how good a job you do. So you need to figure out how to bypass the existing players that screw the energy distribution on Earth up. And you have another caller, and I don't expect you be able to answer that today. But if you really want to make us all happy, there's got to be a better form of distribution because it's evil.
And while I agree with you 100%, going through utilities is probably going to be the lower probability. Again, my challenge is that no utility is going to sign up to buy my business, my business product, until it's proven.
Correct.
So, and that'll take years for them to do that. So, the other option is to do local power grids, and individual communities can do that, and they've been doing that. And the reason that utility scale stuff worked because it only makes sense to build these huge assets from that perspective. Once I have enough assets, building a rectangle on the ground is relatively cheap.
Yeah, it's just the management and the policies. But you've got another call. You are making my phones ring today, John. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, this is Peter Schubert coming back for round two.
Go ahead. Short, because your phone audio is crappy. Go ahead.
John, doing the full Monty of space solar power is a big jump. What would be some intermediate steps and demonstrations that would gather the public opinion, get people to think this is not a death ray but actually a savior technology? And how could you get this introduced to Hollywood to sensationalize it so people start actively pulling and asking, demanding for space solar power?
Oh, great question. So certainly the marketing aspect is going to need to be done, and because there are underlying questions about human health and safety. And I guess you will probably see me on film in the not-too-distant future being a human guinea pig for microwave radiation at the intensity levels that we'll be beaming power on. So first of all, I've got to show that I'm willing to put my health and safety out of life and limb on the line to show that this is safe. The other bit is complying with regulatory. Our initial systems, these 100 megawatt systems we'll put out, the radiation intensity you'll get and I say radiation, but it's really not ionizing radiation. So just so we're clear, microwaves are photons, just like your eyeballs receive in the form of light. It's really just energy transfer in the form of heat. The intensity we'll have for these initial deployments is about 37 watts per square meter, which is way below what the FCC regulates at 50. So some of these initial installations are going to have relatively low intensity microwaves. Something that if you're working in industrial environments where there's microwave dryers and others like that, you're probably already experienced. But we're going to have to show that it's safe and have it operating in a safe manner for a while before other communities say, we can go look at the public records over here and say, yes, they really did a good job of protecting the workers and the people around it. So that's, the first, biggest challenge around the siting is saying, hey, is this safe? And I will go right on ahead and say that, yes, there's actually some good research already, and I'll stand in front of the transmitter to show you that it is safe. But once you have that and you can say it's safe, then obviously you can start the marketing blitz. And having said that, like the vehicle called Gravity, I don't know if you guys have seen that movie about orbital debris taken around the ISS and everything else in orbit.
Yeah, I saw that. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and Sandra Bullock somehow surviving.
With her hairdo intact in microgravity,
well,
yes.
Well,
don't forget that.
Of course. So the orbital debris thing is a big deal, and it wasn't treated well. So you never know how Hollywood's going to promote your stuff. They may make you look like the biggest evil that ever was. So I prefer to control my own marketing, but we'll see. I mean, there are people out there who write science fiction that could, couch the benefits. It's just that no one has written much about it recently. Maybe somebody can do that.
Peter, anything else? Peter?
Well, I was thinking that, John, when you described, the origins of space solar power, you didn't mention Nikola Tesla, who had a lifelong goal to be able to beam power through the ionosphere and to power airships. He was a spectacular self-promoter. And even though he died penniless, and of course that could be a very important lesson, he was able to galvanize a tremendous amount of information, of attention and interest in his technologies. Do you have that kind of personality, or is there somebody on your team who could be that kind of a showman to help educate the public in a broader sense?
That is a great question. I don't know if I am that person. I can't say that I get too many hits on my my YouTube videos. So maybe it's just you're famous because you're rich, or rich because you're famous challenge in the world. But I believe that that kind of communication can be solved. It's having the vision to go after that in the promotion. So does it need to be me? I don't know. I'll be the guy standing in front of the beam, but whether or not I need to go out and be shameless is a whole other question.
Peter, let me move on. We're getting up on 90 minutes, okay?
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. I do have an email again from John, who sent back yet another question. Back in the day, advocates said that the rectenna could be lifted off the ground so that land underneath the rectenna could be used for grazing cattle and crops and possibly other animals, and that everything would be transparent to light, right? Is that
correct,
feasible in what you're talking about?
Yeah, for sure. So for those of you who don't know, once you have a receiving antenna that's absorbing the microwave energy, there's basically no intensity below it. Right. So a lot of the prior rectenna designs are basically, strips of wire hanging in the air. And getting up off the ground is a good way. And multi-use, dual land use is one of the big things. So whether it's open water or pasture land or farmland, those are all desirable. I would say, though, that our plan, and this is the one insight I'll let you guys have into our proprietary technology, is that we actually intend for existing solar power plants to be our rectennas. So there's not a lot of land use required for solar power on the grand scheme of things. So plopping down an existing solar power farms solves a lot of the siting issues and allows us to provide 24 hours a day power with existing infrastructure. So in that case, the dual land use would be energy all the time. Now, there have been several studies that said that cropland operating in the shadow of solar panels works great, and the next generation of solar panels are all called bifacial, which means a lot of light gets through them. And the rectennial portion of that isn't going to block any of the light at all, so or a very small amount, about 2%. So, yes, that's a totally viable use, and if you scale up these systems, you're going to need more and more land set aside for energy harvesting. The good news is that microwave power transmission, you can get a lot more energy on the ground for a given land use because the rectennials themselves are able to absorb about 85% of the energy incident upon them, whereas utility-scale solar is generally 19 or 20%, so 4.5 times smaller for a given you know, power to the grid. So you're going to need a lot less land for a space solar power.
So we're at the 90-minute point, and I get the sense that you have a boatload of more information to share with us, correct?
Always. You know, this is something I've been studying for years, and I can probably speak for another week straight, but obviously it's whether or not your listeners will entertain me.
Yeah, we
or,
can...
or the other way around.
What to we could bring you back if you want to take off from where you left off and talk more about space solar power and what you're doing.
For sure. I mean, it's, I mean obviously there's enough interest that we ran out of time today. So if we can come back and continue this conversation, it'd be great.
What are you? What should we have talked about for this first round for part one that maybe we haven't talked about? So if we're going to move forward for part two. Has part one laid the adequate foundation for part two, or do you need to add something else in?
No, I think we've covered a lot of the basics. I would like to talk about wireless power transmission some more and health and human safety and other aspects of some of the designs have gone prior that haven't been addressed. I mean, like one of the big things, and we've talked about whether or not you're putting a death ray in space or not. Some of the solutions have the power going to the ground via a laser, and again, as I talked about, my intentions are peaceful, so I won't go down the laser route, but laser is a terrible solution. We can talk about why. So I think the geopolitical and health and safety aspects, I think, are really good discussions to have.
Okay, so I can send you my schedule, and we'd be looking at the end of August or the early part of September for part two.
That sounds totally fine.
With an absolute requirement that if people didn't listen to part one, they can't listen to part two unless they've heard part one.
Amen.
I don't know how I'll enforce that, but maybe somebody has a way of how we can enforce that. How many people do you have working for you now?
So I have myself full time, and I have one other part time guy, and I have four part time advisors. So it's a small crew, but enough that we've got a lot done.
What's the tech pool for labor like in Michigan? I'm just curious. Is it rich given engineers there from the car factories, or is it like California or not as good? What do you think?
Well, certainly there are more aerospace engineers in Southern California and in California in general. But we chose to decide the business here for a number of reasons. There's a lot of infrastructure here from a prototyping perspective, and there are some empty plants because, Detroit's very cyclical.
Uh-huh.
The other big thing is that there's more engineers here than anywhere else on the planet, and lots of manufacturing engineers. And I would argue that space solar power, if it's going to be successful, is a manufacturing play. You've got to build and build and build and build. And you have to have the ability to build at scale and at low cost. And there are people here that have made millions of elements for existing car manufacturers and those electronics specifically. And having that know-how to build electronics at scale is a prime reason. And also cost of living in Southeast Michigan is very, very low, so I can pay my employees well and they have a good quality of life. And I would not argue that is true in Southern California and California in general. So I would say that I would just, for interest, for those callers that don't understand, my house when I lived in California the last 5 years was 1,000 square foot. It was $1.5 million, and I have a 3,000 square foot, $250,000 home in Michigan with on three lakes. So I don't really say it's comparable, but my standard of living is much higher here in Michigan, and I have access to the infrastructure I need to build a business.
You have one more call, listeners. This is going to be the last call we take on the day. Can you stay to take it?
Yeah.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hey, this is Steve Las Vegas.
Okay. Hi, Steve. Go for it.
Is the biggest flaw in this approach that for a nation to it's virtually impossible for a nation to defend it? I mean, you can have redundancy with whatever your plan is as far as putting the things in space that we need to transmit. But, you know, it's all high ground behind it. So how can you rely on that if someone could easily knock out your transmitters?
And I'll leave your that. Question is about defensibility, right? And not the intellectual property defensibility, but the, you know, nation state level sabotage and destructiveness. Well,
right, a coal plant in Indiana is hard to attack versus a
it is.
Object in space.
So let me just talk a little bit about orbital mechanics. This system is not going to be in low Earth orbit. Low Earth orbit is 300 kilometers high, and there are several nation states that can get there. The only anti-satellite test that you've probably heard of was a low Earth orbit satellite that got shot down. We are at the high ground that's very hard to get to. Now, if a launch capability that exists commercially becomes viable for others to get there, then yes, you could plant a bomb and you know, make it hard. So one of the big things you're going to have to do is either, you know, incentivize peaceful uses of your customers and have redundancy to your point. And if we're able to scale, then they won't be a problem at all because you'll have enough redundancy that, you know, someone might take out one of them, but taking out all of them might be a bigger challenge. So once you have a manufacturing capability and you're punching out two or three or four satellites a minute and you're deploying millions of them, I would argue that you would have to have a concerted nation-state level effort to, number one, have a launch capability, and number two, the will to destroy basically public property. It, you know, globally public property, not just local, because, you know, we'll be supplying, you know, energy not to, you know, someplace in Indiana. Every single one of these satellites will be supplying energy to somewhere on one side of the planet and somewhere exactly on the opposite. So you might be stabbing yourself in the foot or shooting yourself in the foot to, you know, make sure America gets shot. So
could you,
is truly a global energy distribution system as opposed to local.
Could you just send energy to within space or to the moon or to Mars? And I mean, you're going the opposite direction. But once you have this system up there and running, can you devote some of it to looking outward from space rather than down to Earth?
For sure. All these technologies are viable, especially in, you know, inside the orbit of Mars. Well, Mars or orbit are viable. Again, I'll talk a little bit about the diffraction problem. The further away you are, the harder it is to hit a spot size. But,
right, I understand
Something in Earth orbit can probably put a little bit of power on the moon, but it's probably more worthwhile to put an array around the moon and an array around Mars and an array around somewhere else to collect energy and then direct it to, you know, spots that aren't in the sun. And I'm sure you're aware that dust on Mars is the biggest challenge for solar energy there.
Right.
In fact, there's been some assets that were very expensive to put there that have failed because of dust.
Quit working.
So, yes, absolutely. I mean, power beaming, unfortunately, is a scale problem. You can beam power a long, long ways if you have a big enough transmitter. And building multiple kilometer scale transmitters is what my business is. But tens of kilometers, it'll take a little while to get there, but I'm sure it's doable. And that would allow us to get to all of six-lunar space and then, well, again, further than that, probably worth just sending a payload to whatever, you know, celestial body you'll want to have a solar power system at.
Steve, anything else for our guest today?
That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call.
Thanks, Steve.
John, I'll send you the list for us to bring on part two. And when are you going to be doing fundraising? Are you already starting? Is it down the road?
No, for sure. I think I said earlier in the program that we have our pre-seed, which, again, is mostly a technology demonstration process. We're in the midst of our fundraise. We have a lead investor and all that. And then it's a matter of demonstrating our goals and our milestones and raising the next round. I think as a CEO and a technical founder, you don't realize how much of your time is spent fundraising.
I know.
I expect that the next few years will be mostly fundraising from, most how I use my time.
Okay.
So it's probably a, 7-year minimum kind of thing before it's widely commercially available. And that assumes we hit all our goals and the funding is, available.
Okay. John, I want to thank you. Look for my note in a little while. And listeners, thank you for calling and emailing and participating. And again, our next live program is Tuesday. Do have a great holiday weekend for those of you that celebrate July 4th and everybody else. Have a great long weekend if you get a long weekend. And always remember to keep looking up and stay safe and stay healthy. And make sure you're around for our Tuesday Space Show program. We want to thank John for being with us today and all of you who called again and all of you who emailed. And goodbye from John, David, and the Space Show. And as I said, keep looking up.